Welcome to Healthcare Rounds, the podcast serving you the ins and outs of health policy and business topics, as well as our take on the rapidly evolving healthcare delivery ecosystem. I'm your host, John Marchica, CEO of Darwin Research Group and faculty associate at the W.P. Carey School of Business and the College of Health Solutions at Arizona State University. This week, I'm speaking with Dr. David S. Hong, Deputy Chair of Investigational Cancer Therapeutics at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, where he also serves as Associate Vice President for Clinical Research and Clinical Medical Director of the Clinical Center for Targeted Therapy. Dr. Hong received a bachelor's degree in biology from Yale University and a medical degree from Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He completed an internship and residency at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital and a medical oncology fellowship at MD Anderson, during which time he was appointed Chief Medical Oncology Fellow. In 2005, he joined MD Anderson's faculty. Dr. Hong is the recipient of many awards, including the 2004 Young Investigator Award from the American Society of Clinical Oncology. He has published more than 270 articles in peer-reviewed journals. So, to kick us off, tell me a little bit about your role within MD Anderson.
So I am the deputy director of what's called the Department of Investigational Cancer Therapeutics. It's a specific unit within MD Anderson dedicated to doing early drug development studies in cancer. And these studies are really the first in human studies, oftentimes phase ones. They have evolved in some sense over the last several years. But they're the first steps after animal testing that goes into cancer patients. And so we run that unit or department within the institution. And I'm also the Associate Vice President of Clinical Research. And in that role, I play a number of different roles. I do a number of things. One is one of the important things, and I think one of the challenges, I think, in academic medicine is you know, we have large bureaucratic infrastructures and trying to get some of these trials up and running as quickly as possible. And I'll talk a little bit about that in context of how clinical trials are changing, but also some of these emerging challenges overall in oncology drug development. It's been a challenge for us here to get trials up and running fast, but we have just recently really implemented some key changes that has allowed us to shrink our timelines. And I'm involved in a number of things in that role. I help with managing grants, the internal grants that are being distributed to junior investigators. And I'm involved in kind of going through our clinical trials process here. We have a huge number of studies. We have close to 3,000 trials at Anderson, different trials, whether it's survey or treatment trials. And so a lot of kind of details I have to go through in trying to help manage the clinical trial infrastructure here at Anderson, which is probably one of the largest in the world.
So anybody who's watching the pharmaceutical industry has noticed a surge in cancer drug approvals in recent years. Oh. And some of these drugs are showing remarkable results. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to speak with you was to get your insight from a research perspective, how and why things have changed. And can you talk about what's new in the last 5 to 10 years and why the research landscape is so different today?
Good question. One, you're absolutely right. There's been really a record number of kind of new molecular entities and orphan drugs, both new and also generics and biosimilars in 2018. There was a total of what are called 76 new indications for new drugs in cancer over the last 5 years. And right now, there is close to 1,200 different agents or new molecular entities in clinical trials as of 2018. But that's been growing over the last decade. In 2008, there was about 750, but it's been slowly climbing. Now it's close to 1,200. And why is that? Well, part of that is to a large extent is because we are reaping the harvest of molecular science and investment that has been, and discoveries that have been implemented over the last several decades, right? Dr. Hanahan and Dr. Weinberg are scientists in oncology who wrote this seminal review called The Hallmarks of Cancer. And their first publication was in 2000. At that time, they had listed the classic hallmarks. There were six hallmarks of cancer. But they republished their publication again in 2011, and they added an additional four hallmarks of cancer, particularly avoiding immune destruction. That was one of their emerging hallmarks. Since then, the discovery and underpinning of the understanding of how cancer is so destructive has led to ways to target it. So, you know, I'm in Texas, so we talk about oil a lot, right?
Right.
And we had a fracking event in 2011. And that fracking event, that new technology was immunotherapy. And that was the first time when ipilimumab was approved in melanoma. And soon afterwards, we had a number of new immunotherapy agents, particularly PD-1 inhibitors that augmented the anti-CTLA-4 ipilimumab, that led to obviously even more activity, and also then has emerged other things such as CAR T cells, et cetera. These numbers are probably out of date, but as of March of 2017, there was close to 1,122 cancer immunotherapy combination trials.
Wow.
Again, this is in the individual agents I talked about, the 1,200 agents in 2018. So there's been really an explosion of new trials, new agents, in particular in immunotherapy. It's really transformed the landscape for cancers that we never ever thought were going to be amenable to immunotherapy, such as lung, such as bladder. I mean, we had some indication that melanoma was responsive to immunotherapy, such as IL-2, high-dose IL-2, but those were oftentimes limited in really patients who could tolerate that drug. But these drugs are now, but they have some side effects, have been relatively well tolerated. Third thing, beyond the new molecules, beyond immunotherapy, and number three has really been in parallel to immunotherapy, has been just the refinement and the ability to kind of molecularly phenotype tumors. And that's all the way from things like BRCA mutations, which we knew for a long time, but until just recently had been able to target patients with BRCA mutations with what are called PARP inhibitors. And also other mutations that are relatively rare, but are truly transformative, such as NTRK fusions. I was involved in the phase one, but also the New England Journal phase two and kind of paper that was pivotal, or the studies that were pivotal in the approval of what's called larotrectinib, which is the first NTRK fusion inhibitor. And what's unique about this approval was that it was approved across all tumor types, irregardless of the type of cancer you had, as long as you had an NTRK fusion. And so this was really the second type of drug that was approved, what's called independent of histology or tumor type. The first was actually what's called pembrolizumab, one of the immunotherapy checkpoint inhibitors in a subset of tumors called MSI high. I'm coining this phrase, but I'm sure if you talk with other experts, they would say it truly is kind of this golden era of oncology drug development that we haven't seen for a while.
So that personalization that you're talking about, I was at a conference and there were two doctors, one that was really strong on clinical pathway development and the other one that was speaking about more of the precision medicine. And it was really interesting to see these like two different perspectives, not that they're mutually exclusive, but seeing these two physicians talk about the advantages of either standardization or personalization. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you. They're not mutually exclusive, and both of them are valuable in many ways. I think they will intersect as we become more personalized. So in personalized therapy, I think one of the reason that this is happening more and more is because actually, you know, profiling, molecularly profiling tumors have become much, much cheaper. I remember when I was a resident in, I think it was around 2002, Francis Collins, I think Bill Clinton and Craig Venter made an announcement, I think it was on like national TV, that they had done this incredible profiling of a human whole exome sequencing or whole genomic sequencing of a person's whole genome, right? And I remember the reporter saying that it was a mere $2 billion to make this happen, right? And it wasn't, to be honest with you, and what they didn't really fully tell it was that they hadn't actually done, I think it was only the exomes, I may be incorrect here, but they hadn't really fully profiled everything. It was, they had profiled the vast majority of that genome. And that technology has gotten increasingly better and cheaper than even silicon chips. You know, there's that Moore's law, right? And you can get online now and you can get your whole exome sequence or a whole genome sequence for like under $1,000, right? And so that technology has just incredibly evolved to the point where, you know, we are, you know, routinely getting that and all of our patients here in MD Anderson. You know, CMS recently made that announcement that they would pay for the mutational profile. And there have been some incredible examples like the larotrectinib example that I mentioned to you that truly have shown that the advantages of kind of profiling tumors, et cetera. There are still skeptics. Many of the skeptics would argue that only a percentage of the patients or maybe even a small percentage of those patients may actually benefit from personalized therapy. But that's an assumption that that's assuming the current technology and the current drugs will stay the same. And obviously that, in my opinion, is short-sighted. We will develop new drugs and there will be more and more knowledge and mutations that this personalized therapy approach, I suspect, will be much more a approach that we can follow. And this is being borne out, particularly in lung cancer, where lung cancer, for example, has really been being sliced into smaller pies as to targeted therapy. So it's important to note that trend in technology and processes will continue. And I suspect that, you know, 5 years from now, there will be many more targeted therapies, many more patients who may benefit from personalized therapy than there are right now. But the vast majority of patients are still kind of using standard, you know, chemotherapy. And for example, the NCCN guidelines are a very good guideline as to how we treat patients all the way from early stage to later stage. And so they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. You know, I helped develop something called the VIC protocol or the Vemurafenib Irinotecan and Cetuximab protocol. And that's actually a combination targeted therapy plus chemotherapy regimen that we identified high activity and benefit in patients with BRAF V600E colorectal cancer. That has been now incorporated into the NCCN guidelines for colorectal cancer. And that is a pathway in which oncologists use to make determinations as to how to treat patients. So these aren't mutually exclusive pathways. I suspect, though, that, you know, not just 5 years from now, 10 years or even further down the line, there may be even more nuanced ways, more complex ways in which we identify pathways and personalized pathways, whether it's using AI, right? And utilizing things like whole genome profiling to identify drugs that may cause too much toxicity or may actually and benefit. The data that we use in the context of profiling tumors or using profiling patients is really to determine which patients may actually benefit rather than which patients may actually gain toxicity. So all of that is going to be incorporated in the future to make maybe even personalized pathways. So there may be really a convergence of both of those processes.
Interesting. And I noticed that you actually publish, MD Anderson actually publishes all of your pathways on the website. Why I find that's remarkable is as part of our research into different institutions, I often run into people who, I don't know if the word is proprietary, maybe it's they're secretive about their pathways within their organization, which I don't understand why that would be the case. I mean, certainly MD Anderson is, as I said, publishing them for the world. So I had a recent conversation with another academic institution where many of their docs see their careers advancing through research and publishing. And sometimes, at least according to this person, they struggle to get them to spend time with patients. Obviously, MD Anderson is known for world-class care as well as being a renowned research institution. Do you find it difficult to do both well? Do you face the same kind of challenges with your physician researchers?
Yeah, I think that's an increasing challenge given the current reimbursement environment. But, you know, if you look at the vast majority of revenue and what you need to kind of cover operating costs, I think 85 to 90% of that still comes from clinical revenue. Don't quote me on that. I don't think I know the exact number, but it's around there, right? So the other like 7%, I think, is research, NCI, NIH sponsors, et cetera. And the other 3% is philanthropy. So we know, I think most academic centers recognize where their bread is being buttered.
Sure.
They, you know, continually push academic departments and chairs to ensure that they meet their clinical revenues targets. But as an academic institution, and in order to attract people who are interested in research, you as a chair need to kind of balance all of that and ensure that, you know, you have some time to do research. But I will tell you that it is becoming increasingly more difficult. I mean, if you don't have a grant in some of our departments here, you know, you're seeing patients 4 days a week. And that's essentially the same amount of clinical effort you put in usually in a private practice. You do 4 days a week and then you have a day off to try to catch up and follow patients and orders and stuff like that, right? The challenge though is for an academic centers is that they can't pay these oncologists or pay the physicians as much as they will get in private practice, right? So if you increasingly make it equivalent, you know, time that you're spending just on doing clinical care as you would do in a group practice or outpatient practice without, you know, giving them time to do research, then, you know, what incentive is there to stay in an academic institution? And I've seen that happen with a number of my colleagues who actually graduated from MD Anderson Fellowship, which I did, went off to academia, brilliant people who were, you know, had really promising early careers, got ASCO CDAs, et cetera, or ASCO Young Investigator Awards, but their respective institutions would require them to see a lot more clinical care than they initially signed up for. And eventually they just said, you know, what's the point? You know, and they leave. And usually they leave for two areas. One is private practice or industry. I'm seeing more and more colleagues of mine leaving for industry, that is pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, who need oncologists, who need these experts to help them develop their molecules. So I don't know the answer. What is the right answer to how do you make this balance? I think it's a big challenge for chairs and administrators to try to ensure that academics have some time because, you know, you can't do research with like 1 day a week off. It's really hard because, you know, you're spending some of that time already on clinical care, follow up with patients, et cetera. And to try to actually write papers, write protocols, be on teleconferences or run a lab, it's almost impossible. And so you have to give some margin of time for these researchers. But understandably, if these researchers are not bringing in grants or bringing in protocols or funding, you know, institutions are losing money on every single one of them, right? Mm. I'm not entirely sure which direction this is going to end up going for academics here in the United States. I think there are different challenges, particularly if you're outside the United States. But I'm seeing more and more trials actually moving outside the United States, for a number of reasons. One, it's cheaper for drug companies to actually do trials outside the United States. And two, there are more investigators or clinical trialists who know how to run a clinical trial or even early clinical trials in Asia, in Europe, in Eastern Europe particularly. And so companies are moving towards there. So some of these new novel agents may not become available for patients here in the United States in the future.
So finally, just to wrap things up, before I got on the call, I saw a New York Times ProPublica article about another cancer center where they've had some issues with conflicts of interest. And I don't need you to comment on that. You may be aware of it. But rather, how do you partner with industry? And what's pharma's role as a partner in research and caring for patients?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Pharma is, I would argue, instrumental, at least in the clinical aspect of research. I think the NIH and the NCI has a very, obviously, central, strong role in preclinical research. And to some extent, pharma is having increasingly, there are needs for pharma to also have an increasing role, or pharma and biotech to have a role in also preclinical research. Most of the drugs that are currently approved in the United States was not developed by the government. It was developed by the pharmaceutical industry. The vast majority of new drugs, whether it's in oncology, those 73 indications came from drug companies who invested and poured, I would argue, billions of dollars into research. Now, one can argue, I'm not going to argue about drug pricing, which is, I think, complicated and nuanced here. But part of the reason that they're able to do research is the money that they've poured into this area. We do have collaborations with the NCI in doing clinical trials with them. But the vast majority of clinical trials that are done in this country and in the world are conducted by pharmaceutical companies. And what I think ProPublica and some of the other kind of venues that are kind of trying to vet out this conflict of interest, they may or may not realize this, is that this research probably would not be conducted if it wasn't for pharma trying to, you know, get drugs approved and investing the money in order to try to get these drugs approved. Clinical trials is an incredibly expensive endeavor, and that's also a very complicated reason as to why. But, you know, the numbers range from phase ones from $20 to $50 million phase one, and then you get into a large phase, randomized phase two, it can run up to $100 million, and then doing an international phase three study can be up to $300 million. There's debate as to how much this whole process costs, but if you look at the Tufts Drug Institute, Joe DeMasi has been working in this area for decades, and their data suggests that capitalized costs, that means the cost incurred to get one drug approved, which is usually a 10% likelihood of a drug, only one drug out of 10 that gets into the clinic gets approved, that capitalized cost is probably $3 billion or more. Again, one can debate as to why these drug costs are so high, but without pharma, the United States government does not have that kind of cash to invest in research and getting new drugs out there. So fortunately or unfortunately, that's just kind of the nature of the reality of drug development at this time.
Well, and pharma wouldn't be able to implement those trials unless they were in partnership with the MD Andersons of the world, right? I mean,
yes and no. Increasingly, pharma is moving outside of academia. There's one of the largest clinical trials units in the world, or in the United States at least, is something called Sarah Cannon Cancer Center. And they're not necessarily affiliated with a university. They're part of HCA, a dedicated oncology practice that is really kind of focused on clinical trials in oncology. And they are a juggernaut in oncology clinical trials, but they're not affiliated with any university of any sort. And so that allows them to have lower overhead costs and also allows them to have faster implementation of clinical trials, which which always leads to decreased research costs, right? So to date, we know on average from a drug getting into the clinic and getting approved still takes about 8 years before FDA approval. Things have gotten faster in the last couple of years, but you know, the last paper I read on this, still the average was like 8 to 9 years. And so if you're, for example, a small biotech, you are burning through incredible amounts of cash to pay for your staff, the clinical trials, et cetera. And so the faster you get that up and running and completed, the better. And so MD Anderson's and Dana-Farber's MSKCC, they're still very important in the clinical trial infrastructure, but there are other alternatives that drug companies and pharma are looking at, not including Sarah Cannon, but also outside of the United States. So there are other entities now outside of the United States that are also doing these kind of clinical trials. Now, you know, the FDA, essentially their mandate is that, you know, as long as the data is good, right, and it's been audited and vetted and it appears good, they're not going to necessarily disapprove a drug because it's not done at MD Anderson or Sloan Kettering.
Right. They just want to make sure that the right protocols have been followed and all of the essentials of running a clinical trial is done properly, essentially. So you're all in competitions with each other for those clinical trials.
Correct. I mean, ideally, we shouldn't be in competition, right? Ideally, we should all be working together towards, you know, getting these trials up and running and completed for our cancer patients. But there is some level of competition, I would argue, both really academic competition, but also trying to get slots for patients who are at your institution.
This has been great, Dr. Hong. I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me. I'm sure that our listeners are going to love it, getting a peek into the world of cancer research and care. And yeah, again, thank you. I really appreciate it. That's all for this week. From all of us at Darwin Research Group, thanks for listening. If you haven't yet done so, please rate and review Healthcare Rounds wherever you listen to podcasts. Healthcare Rounds is produced by Diana Nikolic and engineered by Andrew Rojek. Theme music by John Marchica. Darwin Research Group provides advanced market intelligence and in-depth customer insights to healthcare executives. Our strategic focus is on healthcare delivery systems and the global shift toward value-based care. To learn more about us, go to darwinresearch.com or send an email to insights@darwinresearch.com. Or if you'd like to get right to it, call us at 888-402-3465. See you next round.